Hello! After a longer-than-intended break, DOTRR Reviews HBO's Rome is back. I appreciate it if you still listen to and enjoy this feed. Jacob Cole BP and I had a fun time finishing up the series. I should note that we recorded these eps in summer 2023, and our convos have been left unedited on my computer for nearly 6 months because I got a little busy. So if you hear us say something and think, huh, that's a little bit of a dated reference, you'd be very correct, although I'm just trying to keep up with DOTRR's charm and brand. The content is evergreen, the references become continually dated. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoy a review of a great TV show from an expert panel. Hello and welcome to the Death of the Roman Republic's review of the 2005 HBO original series, Rome. Season 2, Episode 1 of HBO's Rome, Passover. Before we get back to it, guys, it's been a couple seasons since we've been on the mic here. Maybe some time has elapsed from, I don't know, when we most recently watched Season 1. Actually, no, that's just factually true. I was curious, how, if at all, did our panel today prep to rewatch here? Would Cole mind describing first how you prep to rewatch, my friend?
Of course. I did very little work to prep for it. I do think I have a fair handle on everything that happened in season one. And considering how I fared when I watched this first episode, I think I was all right for the most part. There were a couple characters whose appearances I didn't quite remember, but I caught back on pretty quick. I did read through the notes I took on episodes of last season, but I only really wrote down notes on episodes I hosted, so it was not quite as helpful as you might imagine.
All right. Jacob, how did you prep at all for this?
Well, you might remember that before watching season one of Rome, I've never seen any television whatsoever.
This is true.
Now I'm proud to say I've seen all the television.
Oh, all of them. Except season two of Rome, correct?
Except season two of Rome. I kept myself the season two of Rome virgin. But everything else I've seen. So every reference you guys make in these coming weeks of podcasting, I will get. And if it sounds like I don't get it, that's just because I didn't think it was funny.
That's fair.
No, but in preparation specifically for season two, I had the intention to power watch the entire season back in the week leading up to today. And then I'd moved in the middle of that and ended up watching two episodes while I was packing, and that was it. But it's the dot that counts.
Fair enough. BP, our resident film TV expert,
did not rewatch the first season. I looked back at some old notes and I did the good old trickery of using IMDb to refresh myself on characters and synopsis of each episode.
Fair enough. I myself, I think I sped re-listened through our first four episodes of season one because I wanted to check that. Did we ever like actually call Mark Antony the big dog? We did, which is relevant to today's episode. Speaking of which, season two, episode one, Passover starts mere moments after the season one finale. As a quick vocab update, the two major factions in Rome at this point are the Caesarians, whose power and influence comes from Caesar. This is people like Attia and Antony, and the faction against them, the Republicans, who conspire to assassinate Caesar, ostensibly to restore the Republic, like Brutus, Cassius, and Servilia. So those are the two factions vying for control. At the start of the series, it was what, Caesarians and Pompeians? Things have changed a little bit. Things have changed, especially since the conspirators, the Republicans, the assassins, succeeded, open to a deserted Senate with a dead Caesar and Posca, his slave, crying over his body. A dejected Antony walks out of the Senate house. Quintus Pompey, the bastard son of Pompey Magnus greets Antony as consul, then draws a gladius. Mark Antony throws his toga at an oncoming attacker and runs away. To my recollection, this is a top three fight scene from the show. Brutus shakes as he washes his face. His mother praises him for saving the Republic, redeeming his name. Brutus says it was awful. She tries to comfort him that they have to be strong, and she asks if he's up to the task. Let's not forget, moments ago, Servilia was rubbing the assassination of Caesar in Adia's face. Let's also not forget that moments before, Varinus's wife Niobe killed herself when Varinus seemed to be about to murder her. Now he cries over her dead body.
Before we go too far, I thought then the Servilia and Brutus moment was very touching in a more kind of, I don't know, ominous sense, but I don't know, you saw the bond between mother and son, and it was one of many touching moments in this episode, and it was just my heart was touched for a lot of this.
I didn't really get that vibe. I kind of got it like that Servilia was kind of like not paying much attention to like how much this like messed Brutus up. Like he's like shaking because of like he's dealing with like what he's just done, and she's just like, yeah, no, that was super rad. Like it's a good thing, and like doesn't seem to really be paying much attention to what he's actually dealing with.
I side with Cole on this because my note was read the room, Servilia.
But you can tell that Servilia is at least partially attuned to the emotions of the situation in Brutus, because like her hands are shaking there in the water bowl too, and like she is crying. And so I don't know. They each their own. Servilia is still perhaps a bad person and evil, but I thought it was a good little thing, a good moment.
Yeah, I think that the Servilia of this season two has become more like Atia. I'll just leave it at that, I guess. Yeah. But okay.
I feel that already.
Yeah.
I still don't like Atia, though. Understand.
Yes, and that, hence my feelings about Servilia.
Varinus sees the young Lucius, who he thought was his grandson, is really Niobe's illegitimate child of no relation to him. Varinus approaches young Lucius, named after him, accosts the young boy, asking whose child it is. His family enters. His eldest daughter, Verena the Elder, tells Varinus to go, stop accosting this small child. Varinus hits her across the face super hard. Niobe's sister Lydi protects Verena from Varinus, while the younger Verena looks at her mother's corpse. Verena's is sobbing, positioned to strike again, but he relents, curses his family, and wanders off. A bloody Varinus wanders through the streets. People shout, Caesar is dead, and running about. Varinus doesn't really seem to care and collapses. A very swole Octavian, if I may, enters the room that Adia is crying in, who is comforted by the slave Marula. Adia requests to be left alone. Octavian leaves. A big departure from their introduction in season one, episode one, if I may.
Significantly more clothes.
Yes, fortunately.
Which is odd because Octavian is visibly older, where I'm still uncomfortable, but somehow less if he's older, right?
No reaction. I plead the fifth. I don't know, Your Honor. Octavian then walks in on his sister Octavia crying. He says, gods, not you as well. Crying will not help. Sigma male activity. Octavia says she's not sad, but angry. Caesar's assassination occurred because of the information Octavia gave to her lover Servilia that Niobe had cheated on Varinus, so the popular Varinus wasn't there to shield Caesar. Octavian says no one can know about their role in this. Glad they're keeping that under wraps. Timon arrives to give his condolences. He twice asks of Adia's condition, beta male activity. He reports that the city's dead silent. People are keeping to their homes. Adia arrives and asks if they're able to leave the city. Octavian advises against this. They don't have a clear picture of what's unfolding or of what Antony may do. Adia thinks Antony is dead. She wants to go, but Octavian says that would be playing into Servilia's taunts. Enter a sweaty Antony. I swear on the Black Stone, I will kill them all. Antony is angry. Patty asks why he didn't try to stop them, and he said that he had been delayed and thinks Varinus might have been paid off because he abandoned them far earlier. Attius says it was all Servilius doing, luring Varinus away. So all the characters are getting kind of caught up of what we, the audience, already know.
I could not believe that Mark Antony actually showed up. Like, they're talking like, oh, he's dead. Oh, but he could be alive. He could be alive. And if he were to be alive, he would come to me first. He would come to me. And I'm like, there's no way he would come for you, Adia.
Like, doesn't he not like you anymore from my recollection?
Jacob, I think you might forget, though, that Mark Antony is the main character of Roman history. So, I mean, you got to factor that in.
Yeah. He do got that dog in him.
Adia asked Antony what had happened next, and Antony said he couldn't do anything to protect Caesar because he was unarmed. Adia says she would have ripped him to pieces with her bare hands. Antony says, you know, nothing of violence, as he shoves a slave away who's trying to help him put his boots on. Just a mean guy, man. Always someone there, an enslaved person, to remind you these are not morally righteous people.
I would have loved to see Adia in that Senate hall and see what she actually would have done. I wager somewhere between screaming and crying.
I am inclined to agree. I'm inclined to agree. That's basically what she was doing when Servilia was telling her the plan. But Adia asks, what do we do now? Antony says she can do as she likes. He plans to go north, gather his forces, invade Rome. Then Adia is upset that Antony is so flippant about her. And Antony's like, oh, I didn't mean anything by it, baby. Of course I want you with me. And Adia's like,
yeah, come on.
Addie is like, you can go take one of your other lovers. She doesn't want to go north. Antony tells Timon they are going north, and they need Caesar's wife Calpurnia as well, because they cannot abandon her. It is politically disadvantageous. Varinus gets mugged by a holy man who headbutts him, and he and a kid steals his jewelry. Who among us hasn't been there?
What a hustle, you know. And you know what? If I was blind, would I do any different? Who knows?
In this economy?
Yeah.
Varinus is really having like a character low right now. Like, this is like rock bottom.
I mean,
like, he hit rock bottom over the course of what feels like 10 minutes.
Yeah, presumably 10 minutes ago was when his wife's body hit the concrete. So, yeah.
I love that statement that this is Varinus's rock bottom. Polo is enjoying his new life with Irini. He apologizes
Polo's
for
in
not
a different show.
I only a couple scenes later he gets back to it, but Polo apologizes for not starting their relationship off right, i.e. murdering Irini's husband.
This to me was my funniest moment of the episode.
This was depressing.
It's because of how Ray Stevenson, rest in peace, delivers the line. He said, sorry, I killed your man. Anyway, and okay, just goes on to treat it like it was nothing.
Common Polo W.
I will just say, this forest they're at is so pretty. I was getting nature envy looking at that place.
Yeah.
Jacob, your inner biology is coming out.
Yeah.
Polo states that he doesn't want to be Irini's master, but husband. He wants her to choose him, and he says he'll provide for her, but he's not going to threaten her. Irini says that she will marry him. They mark each other with soil and kiss. Jacob, you played right into my hand, you fool. You had messaged me earlier that this marking each other with soil and kissing, that was your ideal marriage, buddy. You know, I got you down there. Cut to Calpurnia looking at Caesar's dead body as her household mourns. She gestures for a woman to approach and breastfeed Caesar. Jacob, you messaged me that this is your ideal funeral.
Hey, I wrote down here.
Yeah, I'd assume this was some weird Roman thing and didn't question it any further.
You know, this and the soil thing, back to back, a bunch of weird Roman tradition things happening. But it makes sense, right? The first thing you drink upon being born, mother's milk. Oh. And so I see the reason. The last thing you drink, some other woman's milk.
See, I saw it as like, you know, it's providing nourishment to the land of the dead for the journey there. That was my take.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Posca notes that visitors are here. It's Antony, Atia, Octavia, and Octavian. Calpurnia says they're the first and only to come. Antony says that they're leaving. She needs to come too, but Calpurnia doesn't want to. But now that they're here, they can be witnesses to Caesar's will. Antony says they don't have time, but Calpurnia stands her ground. So Posca reads it out. Part of the estate is set aside for Calpurnia. 75 denarii goes to every Roman citizen, which Atia huffs is a waste. My funniest moment of the episode. The remainder of the estate, including all of Caesar's obligations and benefits, is bequeathed upon Octavian, who is posthumously adopted as Caesar's son and sole heir, which is a real nutty. It's you find out after a person dies that they are adopting you as their son. Real thing to ponder.
This was kind of an L for Caesar for me, in that he gave nothing to his boy, our dog, Mark Antony.
Well, yeah, Antony's like, what else? What else? And Posca's exactly. Well, I'm free.
He's like, I'm out of here. Along with all the money and things, Octavian also acquires name, doesn't he?
Yeah, you know, it's not explicitly stated in this episode, but Octavian's name, should he accept this, would change. Antony congratulates Octavian. Antony, you know, took this news of receiving nothing fairly well, I think, overall. He says, though, Octavian's not going to get anything because Brutus and his minions control the law. Posca says Brutus will argue that the death of Caesar was a lawful tyrannicide, that the tyrant's laws and acts will become null and void, and his property will be seized. Octavian notes that they can't take away the name he would receive as Caesar's adopted son, officially being a part of the Caesar family, which Antony agrees with in kind of a smart aleck way. Antony plans to take Calpurnia by force, but then Octavian gets a little glint in his eye. He says they must stay in Rome. He must protect his inherited estates. And when Atia says, we gotta go, he pulls rank and says, I'm the new head of household. I say where we're going. And then Octavian starts explaining the plot, essentially, for all of us. He states that Brutus is in a legal bind because Brutus wants Caesar's death labeled as a tyrannicide and not murder. But if it is tyrannicide, all of Caesar's laws and appointments, including the positions that Brutus and other conspirators hold, become invalidated, so Brutus and his company would lose political power. If Brutus honors the law, he loses rank and position. Octavian says they should offer amnesty to Brutus, which both Antony and Atia think is daft, but Octavian says they don't understand, and then plays to Attia's narcissism. If the will stands, Atia is mother to the richest man in Rome, but if not, Servilia is, so Atia is convinced to stay from there.
That simple, baby.
Indeed, indeed. Pollo and Arini are at an Airbnb when a horse rider announces that Caesar is dead. Pollo commits assault in Grand Theft Auto and speeds back to the main plot.
It's
I was gonna make a Grand Theft Auto joke as well.
Well, it's Red Dead Redemption, right? That's the Grand Theft Auto game for horses.
That's true. Oh, that's true. Yeah. I guess
less funny is a punchline, but.
Let's see. Lydie and Verena clean Niobe's body. Little Lucius cleans his mother's blood off the pavement. Lydie dresses Niobe in jewelry. Enter the gangster Erastes Fulman, saying, hello, children. Cicero enters Brutus's household, celebrating them. Immortals! Immortals! He's jealous that he wasn't invited in on the conspiracy. Cicero inquires a few things. Brutus says that he believes he has the city under his control. Caesar's allies have fled, but Cicero's disheartened to learn Mark Antony, the dog, is not dead. And I think it's incredible that in 2007, HBO's Rome was already giving Death of the Roman Republic fan service.
Before we press on too far, I got the sense here from Cicero that he was saving face very badly. This may just be because I don't remember exactly the politics of how everything ended. Right? Correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection tells me Cicero was very torn about the idea of Caesar leading. Like, he wasn't in love with the idea of like being dictator, but I don't think he explicitly wanted him dead, right?
To my recollection, and it's really awesome that none of us actually rewatched the season one. But, to my recollection, the best way to describe Cicero's position is that he wants a republic where Caesar is not dictator, but he is also one to follow the letter of the law to a T, and is therefore not willing to kill the tyrant, I guess, himself. And I think that's the vibe he gives off, I guess.
Yeah, okay. That's how, and I, yeah, would... that still speaks to that, because it definitely seems like he's like, hey, you guys are in charge, man. I would have been there. You know, I would have been there. I mean, I wasn't, but I would have been.
Well, I
mean,
Jacob, I also got the vibe of him saving face from a little later in the scene.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I think, like, Cicero is significantly more two-faced in this single episode than we ever saw him in, like, the entire first season. And I don't think that's necessarily out of character, but it's just, like, he's just flip-flopping a lot.
Yeah, I felt like that, but I wasn't sure. I was like, God, this man is just like, he's all over the place now. I don't remember this.
Well, even in this initial scene, because the next scene, or the next thing that Cicero says is that I need to leave Rome. I've got to go to the country, deal with this lawsuit. It's like, he's praising the conspirators and the assassins, but he's like, I am also getting out of Dodge because I don't know what's coming next here, buddies. Mm-hmm. He's just there to celebrate, congratulate them. Got to hit the road, deuces. And he turns, walks right into Big Dog Antony. Friend Cicero, why so pale? And Cicero sighs. Cue laugh track. Varinus returns to his empty property. Polo and Irini enter and ask what happened. Varinus is shell-shocked, only recalling Polo's rank. Polo sees Niobe's body and asks what happened, and Varinus explains that he was going to kill Niobe, then she killed herself. Varinus doesn't know where his children are, but he had cursed them to Hades. Antony sits with Brutus, Cassius, Servilia, and Cicero, who announces himself as an impartial and surprised arbiter. Antony says that Quintus Pompey, who's there, must leave or he's going to open his throat. Quintus tried to kill him this morning. Brutus denies that this could have happened, but Cassius says there were some who were a little overzealous, and Brutus is distraught that Cassius would go behind his back. Nonetheless, Quintus gets shuffled out of there. And then the best scene of the episode happens, where Antony starts just chewing the scenery. Antony's using Octavian's spark notes to describe the political situation with his classic Antonian swagger. Why so quiet? The tyrant is dead. And Antony states his position. The people love Caesar. They are going to turn against Brutus and the Republican faction. Antony implies he's going to inherit all of Caesar's political power. Those who are willing to fight for Caesar are now going to fight for him. The Republicans argue they hold the levers of political power. And then Antony, he drops the bomb. Best wait till after the elections, though. And he explains that if you're pulling the tyrannicide card, none of us have power. None of us are in charge. And elections can get quite messy, and Antony doesn't want that. He wants peace and stability. So his solution, Caesar is not declared a tyrant, and the Republicans, the assassins, are not considered murderers. All of them will keep their posts, their positions in power. Caesar's laws will be upheld, including his will. It will be as if Caesar was struck by lightning.
So good.
I loved that, just like everyone in the room, like all the Republicans, just had like the shock Pikachu face the entire time.
I think this goes to show that Mark Antony is very good at getting his way, not just in a battle sense, because I think there are moments in season one where we do see his political game come into play, but we saw more of him as a fighter in season one, and I'm glad to see that in season two we're kind of seeing more of his political intelligence.
I could not agree more. You see a really good breadth of his character and like how cold and calculating he actually still is, which I guess stands to reason. It's how you get into political power in the first place, is like some amount of calculating. But yeah, it's great. It's such a pin and such a bind they have him in.
I also love the kiss on the cheek that he gives when he's hugging Brutus. I thought that was a pretty good like cherry on top to the entire negotiation with it.
Indeed, indeed. Antony goes on to negotiate. He wants a public funeral for Caesar, led by both factions, being Antony and Brutus. Mourn the man, burn the tyrant. Antony then says he'll retire after he serves as consul, like Cincinnati, Ohio did or something. But if they don't accept, Antony will seek to annihilate the Republicans. Servilia asks for some time to think. Antony will wait outside. Brutus is mad at Cassius for going behind his back trying to kill Antony, and then literally everyone suggests that they go kill Antony right now. Antony outside stares down Quintus. Brutus walks out. He tells the consul Antony, "We shall be friends." They embrace. Antony kisses him.
This is great. Brutus is great. This is a great character moment for Brutus. Right? Everyone's like, "Kill Mark Antony. Hey, just kill Mark Antony. You killed one person. Why not kill another person? I'll be twice dishonored, a killer and a fool." And it spoke a lot to Bruce's character and like how much respect he did and still does have for Caesar, but also just like the establishment of Roman law. It's like, oh, I'm not just going to kill him for killing's sake.
Yeah, he's trying to be principled in what he's did as much as possible, and he doesn't see Antony as the same kind of threat. He imagines that Antony, mm-hmm. without Caesar, is just going to, I don't know, blow up in his own face, essentially. Mm-hmm. Antony goes to walk off of Brutus's property, but then he turns to face Quintus. He smiles. He raises his arm like he's going to go in for a hug, maybe a little kiss. He then slices open Quintus's throat in the street. Alpha male move. Big dog is back, baby.
Also, great character moment for Mark Antony right here, because he plays it so cool all the time. But when he turns from like that hug with Brutus, you see like relief wash over his face, because you recognize like he knew how much danger he was in walking in there. He very easily could have died, but it all comes up big dog, baby.
Every time. Forever.
I was so happy when he killed Quintus, just because like I was like, I got the vibe of like when that, not about necessarily about him killing Quintus, it was about like when he like went in to talk to Brutus about like, yeah, so what's the deal. It's like, if Brutus says we're enemies, he's killing him right now.
Cole, I'm so surprised you had said that, because I also had another joke that I'm so sorry for you that the last Pompey we're ever going to see on screen is murked. So Cole just taking L after L on Team Pompey over there.
Look, Quintus Pompey has been a Trump. He was never my guy.
Okay, I misheard an ump in there, I think. Okay. Polo cleans Varinus. Varinus regrets cursing his children. Polo says, they'll be back. You can lift the curse. It isn't sealed because you didn't kill an animal. Reject modernity, embrace tradition. The newsreader announces the funeral for Gaius Julius Caesar.
I'm so glad you did that, Kay. I'm so glad you did that, because this is the best. It's not the best moment in the episode. I thought it was the best moment in the episode until I watched more episode, but it's the funniest moment in the episode. I cannot tell you how excited I was. I didn't know I missed this guy until I saw him on screen. And like, I was like, wow, Rome really is on the Italian peninsula, isn't it? Because look at these hand gestures. Boy, it's killing it. I was like, I got to go to this funeral.
Right, yeah, I don't speak American Sign Language, but Latin Sign Language, I get what those arm jabs mean. Mm-hmm. Servilia and Calpurnia meet in funeral attire. Do you think this will happen to Hillary Clinton and Monica Lewinsky someday? Calpurnia spits on her face twice and permits her to see what she's done. I'm not gonna like overanalyze the look on Servilia's face looking at Caesar's body. She does that.
Can I overanalyze this scene? I got something to say about everything. I'm so sorry.
No, there, give it up. Yeah, yeah.
I got something to say too, but mine is pretty
okay,
small.
I was first, yeah.
Stoked both times that Calpurnia spit on her. I was like, yes.
It rules. It's also a very visually striking scene, because here are two people that Caesar is romantically connected with, right? But they're like, I'm going to use a word incorrectly, dialectically. They are opposed, right?
Diametrically
opposed, right? Mm-hmm. And they're superficially very similar looking, Calpurnia and Servilia, in a way. You know, they're both these pale-skinned, red-haired women of the similar stature, and they're like, you know, in this doorway looking upon one another, and just like complete opposite sides of the coin, and complete like opposite sides of, I don't know, Caesar's influence and like influence. Did I say influence twice? Yeah, I really meant influence. But yeah, it was cool and it ruled.
Thank you, Jacob and Cole. Octavian and Polo talk about what they know about the conspiracy to kill Caesar. They put all the pieces together. Octavian apologizes to Polo and asks that they keep this between themselves, that his role in this wouldn't look good with the people. Polo says, you'll be wanting some vengeance then? Octavian says, at some point. They're very casual, these two.
I just love seeing this duo back. When Octavian tells them about how he was named Caesar's heir and son in the will, and he just says, congratulations. It just doesn't have any like excitement. He's just like, oh, okay.
I think it's really good that Octavian has Polo in his life as like a fellow snuff film enthusiast, and also just like as someone who can just be real and blunt with him 100%. Like, Polo might be the only character who has like zero kind of front, I guess. You know, that dude's just honest to a fault.
I was a little surprised when Octavian was talking to Octavia earlier. He's like, we can't let anyone know about our involvement in Caesar's assassination. And then he's like, hey, Polo, I was involved in Caesar's assassination.
So there I was.
And Polo is not a man I would be telling a bunch of like potentially disastrous secrets to. I would be worried he might let something slip while he was hammered.
This is true. This is possible. All right, we can keep powering through for a little bit longer. Varinus kneels in front of Niobe's body as Irini chants. Antony lazes in bed as Adia chastises him. Antony is confident it'll be his day. Antony wants to have sex with Adia. Adia declines and tells him to get out of bed. And then Antony utters the best line, bar none, in the series. Would anybody care to take it?
I'll take it. I've never f***ed someone in a funeral dress.
Oh, that was not the line I was thinking of. It's very adjacent to that. I guess I'm going to need two censored noises this episode.
I could take a stab at it. I think I know what line you're referring to. I'm not getting out of this bed without f***ing someone.
There we go. There we go.
I thought the funeral dress one was pretty good, too.
I mean, it was different strokes, I suppose. Polo tells Varinus that the Undertaker is there for Niobe, but Varinus wants to wait for the children. Polo tries to reassure him they'll be back, and we see Niobe being cremated. Antony and Brutus get ready for Caesar's much more formal funeral. Jacob, you had a note here with Antony in preparation?
Well, so in the previous scene where we saw Antony, right, he was like, I'm not leaving bed till someone, you know, sleeps with me. And like this scene like opens up with like, it starts on just a naked woman heaving on the bed. And then there's like Antony getting dressed like completely unfazed, and we're just left with like the impression of he just like did some work and
all in a day's work for the big dog Mark Antony.
I'm not gonna lie, it was really cool.
Newest category, coolest scene. All right, Brutus and Antony, they get ready for Caesar's much more formal funeral. All other characters are attending and shooting glances at each other. At Caesar's cremation, there is nearly a riot as citizens push against soldiers to put fuel on a fire. Metaphor.
Something that I really like about this sequence and the way it is edited is how much of a contrast these funerals are. One is just feeling much more authentic, and the other just feels more obviously for show, as that is kind of the point, because you feel like there's more care with Niobe's funeral and just like the way Varinus sets it up and the way he's setting up the wood and things like that, whereas with Caesar's you're just seeing like people just like throwing wood across, and no matter like what it is, it's not even necessarily chopped up to be firewood, it's some of it's just like wheels from barrels or other household items just being burnt, thrown to Caesar's cremation. So I kind of liked seeing that compare and contrast.
Now, yeah. BP, I love this juxtaposition as well. And I kind of agree and disagree. I obviously, yeah, they're very different and very purposefully they're set next to one another. And it reminded me of a theme we talked a lot about in season one, which was the classism present in Rome, where the elites look down upon all the commoners. And here we see the pomp, the circumstance, the grandeur of Julius Caesar's funeral, where the entire city has come out and they're all raving about it. And then the just kind of small affair in the woods seems kind of, a little more run down and less purposeful. I don't know. I think that's the exact opposite of what you said is my impression. But I think it potentially, if you were to look deep into it, it speaks to that classism that's present, or just how different those two worlds of the side of living in Rome are. Because it's not like Varinus was even like, you know, a peasant, like he was well off. And this funeral that Niobe's having is like nothing.
Well, that's right. That's more of what I'm meaning by the idea that what, like, Varinus is feeling like the funeral has a bit more, like, he wants to actually celebrate Niobe's life in a way, whereas Caesar's funeral is more for the like you said, the pomp and the circumstance, and also for really just because that was the agreement that Antony and Brutus came up on to do, because they weren't planning to do one initially, and that was just part of that agreement that they came up with. So really it wasn't for anything authentic or for the people that loved Caesar. It was more for the idea that we're doing this because it's society says we have to, and it looks good on our end if we unite at this funeral. Whereas Barinus's funeral, yes, it may be smaller in scale, but there just seems to be more care put into it for that reason.
Sure. Yeah. After Caesar's funeral, a despondent Brutus tells Antony he doesn't want to run away from Rome, as Antony suggests doing. Antony says Brutus gave an excellent speech, and Antony himself got a little carried away. Antony implores Servilia to tell Brutus and company to leave the city because he can't guarantee their safety, and Servilia sees the game that he's trying to play. Antony says that he would have the Republican men out, and Servilia would stay with him as a hostage. Cassius says that he has the Senate on their side, men of quality. Antony yells, "I got an angry mob." Returning from the funeral, Varinus's children still aren't back. Lydie is, though, recovering things lent to Niobe, apparently, and they ask where the children are, and Lydie says Erastes Fulman took them. We then see that Brutus and Cassius indeed go on to leave Rome, and then at a pub, Erastes Fulman is hearing about how the funeral speech went, how boring and pretentious Brutus was, and how Antony's was so great and emotional, and he showed off Caesar's bloody toga. Erastes Fulman, who apparently kidnapped Varinus's children, thinks it's disrespectful for all of this to have occurred at a consular funeral, and threatens violence on anyone who praises it. In a steam room, he goes on blaming foreigners and slaves for Rome's problems. In the background, women scream while Erastes relaxes, and it quiets, and a bloody Varinus enters with a gladius. Varinus states Erastes has his children. Erastes says, "Oh, he doesn't really know what's going on here." Erastes escapes into the pub and sees that Pullo and Varinus has killed all of his men. Pullo says Erastes still might live if the children are unharmed, and Erastes starts to present himself as a dead man already and says that Varinus isn't a madman, he's just got too much anger in him. Erastes says that he took Varinus's children in payment for Varinus's many slights to him. He says that he raped the children and then killed them. Varinus decapitates Erastes Fulman, walks with his head throughout the street. And that is season 2, episode 1, Passover. Gentlemen, thoughts on the episode as a whole?
Can I get some thoughts on this last scene?
Yeah, totally.
First, because oh my gosh. Oh my
gosh. It was a heavy scene.
Gracious. Remind me of Varinus's, his actor who plays him, what's his name is?
Kevin McKidd.
Kevin McKidd. Bravo. I mean, he sells the rock bottom very hard, because he walks into that sauna room where Erastes is just laying down. And from the wide angle, you can like already see the blood that is just completely draped over his face. And suddenly everything comes into context why there was fighting outside, and you know exactly what has happened. And like it comes tight on his face, and you see like his eyes wide, and like he looks deranged, covered in this blood. And it is just so effective. And once again, very cool. And it is good.
I think that there's a lot that is said in this episode about Varinus just not being able to catch a break, and it's really just kind of like he had started to kind of get up into the ranks in season 1, and then it all just kind of crumbles down in a matter of few days for him, and it just really sucks. And it's kind of one of those things where no matter what he was going to do, he was going to hear something he didn't want to hear. He had his mind made up. It's the Hank line in Breaking Bad. "You're the smartest guy I ever knew, and yet you didn't know he made up his mind 10 minutes ago."
Jacob, you get that reference, right?
Oh, I get it so hard now. Sorry, I should have said I actually do get that one.
he just didn't think it was funny.
You know, this, you guys got me thinking here, reminded me, you know, this is really weird to say. Throughout the entirety of this episode, Polo is the 100% rational one, while Varinus is acting like a madman, basically, which is what we call a dynamic shift.
I really liked this episode. As I said when we started recording, it was a huge downer, but I really liked it. Like it felt like we needed this like rock bottom so that we could rise up from it and see where we go from here. And I will say, you know, this might be a bold claim. Best episode of the season so far.
God.
But for real, like it is like the actual first episode, but I loved it. I thought this episode was great. Like like the death of Caesar, the season finale, you know, it's like a big inhale, right? This big tense moment. And this first episode here is the relief, quote unquote, afterwards. And it's all the grief and the unfolding of everything out there. And there's so many good moments between characters, just like reinforcing the dynamics that we already know. And it's just really solid. It was a phenomenal start to the season, I thought. Just really incredible stuff.
I thought it was a good start to the season, not a great start.
I can't believe this guy.
I'm outraged.
Don't get out the pitchforks. Just because I don't love it doesn't mean I hated it. I liked it. I thought it was a good start to the season. I think that it really was a very good calm after the storm moment, and it really sets up the chessboard for what season two is going to look like. The problem that I had with this episode is because it is a season premiere, it has so much going on that it almost kind of felt a little overstuffed for an hour-long episode. And I felt that there was just so much going on that scenes kind of didn't really get enough time to fully breathe in some moments. And there are moments that are really good in this episode. I just think that there are just some that I wish either had been cut or fleshed out a bit more.
I can see you on the point, BP, of maybe some scenes could go a little bit longer time to breathe. What's a scene you think could have been cut, though?
That's my question.
Mm-hmm.
Not to put you on the spot.
Okay, you can cut out my part where I said cut things out. I'd say flesh out just a bit more.
I don't know if I edit that well, BP, but okay.
That's a hard cut.
Okay,
that's
okay.
A hard cut.
Well, an example of something that I would cut, seeing Caesar's body, like, it's when Servilia and what's Caesar's wife's name again?
Calpurnia.
Yeah, when they see each other, the moment before that, I think, was just kind of unnecessary. It's the breast milk part.
Oh.
I'm just kind of like,
Jacob's getting out the pitchfork.
Yeah, there's a specific subset of people that would say that scene was very necessary.
It was integral.
My question is just, I can understand the analysis of what you were trying to say about it, Jacob and Kay. I when I wrote it down, I said, what is the point of this? I said, why is this here? Is there anything that really affects the narrative of this episode to have that in?
I would say the argumentative person in me would say, oh, you know, it honors the traditions of Rome and helps build the world that we are inhabiting. But to each their own, I think it's a fair criticism.
I will say I do agree about parts of the episode should have gotten more fleshed out, which we will get to a little later.
All right. Well, with that, guys, we will go ahead and get out into our old friends, the breakout rooms between our respective cast here. So Jacob and I will talk about history in the episode, how it compares to Death of the Roman Republic podcast. Whereas BP and Cole, I had a question for you guys, and I want you to make some predictions. This whole game here again. BP and Cole, I want you to make a team of six characters who you think will be dead by the end of the season. And I've pulled some of our principal characters, not necessarily all main characters, some maybe more side characters, from IMDb. So you have more than six to choose from, but I need you to pick six who you think will be dead by the end of the season. Varinus, Polo, Attia, Servilia, Brutus, Octavia, Cicero, Calpurnia, Cassius, Irene, Octavian, Newsreader, Pasca, Timon, Antony, like basically any character that spoke this episode, we'll put on the chopping block. You guys understand the stakes there?
Yes.
Jacob, how'd you feel about the depiction of history in this episode?
Nothing glaring stood out to me. I don't think, you know, it's all very contained to, like, you know, mostly like a singular day or two.
Yes.
And so there's not like wide swaths of history that, you know, we're encompassing here. In my recollection, it all seemed mostly fine.
I am inclined to agree, Jacob. It's a very micro look at history. Mm-hmm. I wanted to note, I mean, really, I don't know, the only history I have to talk about is like, yeah, this episode is pretty accurate, because Caesar's will with Octavian is pretty accurate, even him like just giving money to the common people to appease them after his death to so they remember him magnanimously. The Caesarian faction and the Republican faction had to hash this out legally. They had to acknowledge Caesar was not a legal tyrant, so Brutus and Cassius and the like didn't lose their actual political positions. Important to note, and not necessarily highlighted in the episode, Antony, at the time of Caesar's death, was a consul, and Caesar was also a consul. So there's always supposed to be two consuls that can check and balance each other. They are the chief executives of the Republic. Of course, Caesar was also a dictator, so he just did whatever he wanted. But now that Caesar is dead, no dictator, no other consul, Antony currently has no co-consul to check his power as the sole executive of the Republic at the present. So,
which is part of the reason, correct me if I'm wrong, why like Cicero is like so keen on Mark Antony being killed. Right.
Yes. Yes. Just because, you know, Cicero never had a liking for Antony much in the first place. And now he's, I don't know, there's no one holding the leash, as it were.
That dog's going to go crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jacob, you brought this up as well. The whole naming scheme with Octavian and stuff. I think I had said previously, Octavian's name throughout most of the series is kind of somewhat inaccurate, you might say.
Yeah.
Do you kind of recall the, I don't know, the minutia of all that?
My recollection, because I also meant to re-listen to the pod, but time has gotten away from me.
That's fine.
My recollection is that his name is like actually basically just Julius Caesar after he adopts that name, right? But for the sake of clarity and talking through history, we refer to him as Octavian and then his eventual other name. Just so it's very clear that we're speaking about two different people in two different times of the Roman Republic. Is that mostly right?
Yeah. No, that's smart. So the man born Gaius Octavius in real life, in real history, you know, they don't depict it totally accurately in HBO's Rome, which I don't fault, you know, it would make things confusing for the audience. So throughout the series, HBO's Rome, Octavian is always called Octavian, basically. But in real life history, because we need to give him time to think here, I'll go through the minutiae here. So Octavian in HBO, well, he's born Gaius Octavius. He is always called Octavius up until he's adopted by Caesar. When he's adopted by Caesar, he becomes his legal son. He gains his name. So Octavius's name becomes Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus, but we call him in most textbooks just Octavian at that point. So it's a very minor shift in most textbooks, Octavius to Octavian. In HBO, they just call him Octavian the entire time, though, basically. One smart thing that a really great biography of Augustus did, though, is he referred to Julius Caesar always as Julius Caesar, and he referred to Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus just as Caesar, because when Octavian was alive, I'm trading names so much, I'm sorry if this is confusing, but when Octavian was alive, he wouldn't have been calling himself Octavian. He wanted everyone to know that he was the son of Caesar, so he would have been calling himself Caesar at that time, which the show doesn't really do too much, as I recall. At this point, it's been like 6 years since I've seen it, though, so that actually might come up again, but yeah.
And that feels like, I don't know, nice, because it like in speaks to the influence of that name and the titles that it birthed later on and throughout across histories of different civilizations. So
indeed. That's good. All right, guys. Well, I'd love to hear the list here. Six characters you think are not making it to the end of the series.
All righty. We have named our six. Those six are Mark Antony, Brutus, Cassius, Servilia, Irene, and we wanted to throw a bone with you on this one because this is a character that is most likely going to play prevalence later on in this season. We have thrown in the one and only Cleopatra.
Okay.
No, I won't let her. I won't let her die.
I can save her.
Also, Kay, I'm sorry if you have to edit out some background noise. There are fireworks going off in my neighborhood for some dumb reason. And also, my dogs are going crazy now because of it.
I mean, it is the day before the 4th.
Yeah.
I mean, some yes, reason. But I'm saying I'm sorry for how much editing of background noise you might have to edit out now because of this.
No, it's all right. That's my I don't know. Cross the bear hasn't happened yet in history, so I need a different metaphor. But anyways, let's see. Guys, we'll just go with the favorite moments and least favorite moments, if you had any.
I liked the moment where Varinus, the moment after Varinus curses his children, and he is walking down the alleyway. And the reason why I really like this is because, in a lot of ways, this is very much a low point for Varinus. And I kind of like that this way he's walking down the alley and the street is kind of nightmarish looking, almost like it kind of is just his real world nightmare from his perspective. And it kind of looks like what nightmares in a lot of film and television kind of look like, where everything just seems so disjointed and the person's head isn't 100% clear. And I think that it really was a good standout moment because of just how it looked.
Two thoughts, BP. It's interesting you say that, legit, because later when he's getting conned by the old man, he's like, I want to wake up, mm-hmm. And then he gets headbutted. And two, it's kind of funny because you with the Zoom blur background kind of look like you're in a nightmare right now. But...
It was the plan the whole time.
Yeah, you're just going method. Let's see.
Going all Jeremy
you got
Strong
a favorite, Cole?
I have a couple of favorites. My first one is just generally the whole scene where Mark Antony was just like giving the Republicans the business. But the very first part where he's like, yeah, quiet. Do you hear that? Like, if the citizens were happy he was dead, they would be cheering, but they're quiet because they're not. I was like, that's great, because I knew exactly like what he was going for the second he was like, yeah, do you hear that? I was like, yeah. And then my other one is a small one. It's right before Niobe's funeral when Varinus is sitting there and Polo goes up to him and just like holds his forehead to him. It's just like this moment of like solidarity. And it's like, yes, they love each other. They're family. I'm here for it.
That was my favorite moment in the episode. There's that one right there. Polo's comforting Varinus. Like, Varinus is like so distraught. And like Polo's like, it's fine. The children will come back. But then like, yeah, he gets in really close. He's like, hey. Basically like, we're brothers, man. I got this, we got this, you'll be okay.
I mean, it's almost been a year since we watched season 1 episode 11, but like in the timeline of the show, like 48 hours earlier, is that when Varinus rescued him in the gladiatorial ring or something? It's like gotta be less than a week.
It's a
right?
quick like, turnaround. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's something like that.
But I did have an honorable mention. It's really hard not to pick that final Varinus scene as my favorite one too. I just think it's so poignant. Not poignant's not a good adjective for it, but it's a good scene. So
anyone have a least favorite moment to share? I think Cole at least does.
Yes, sort of. So my least favorite moment is more of a least favorite non-moment, and it's
I think we might have the same one.
We didn't get Antony's speech.
Yes,
like they talked that thing up like it was a sight to see. Or a sound to hear, I guess, but we get none of it.
I 100% agree with that, Cole. That's literally mine. And I ripped off mine from the History Buffs YouTube channel, which he said on his review of HBO's Rome. It's like literally, you have one of the best fictional speeches of all time. Brutus is an honorable man from Shakespeare. Like, you can, you, there's no copyright strikes on that. You can rip that off if you want to. They did it with When Harry Met Sally in, like, the second episode of the series. So surely they could rip off, like, one of these greatest speeches. I sincerely would have loved to see James Purefoy, like, delivering that. And also, it would literally show how the riot got started and Antony turning the majority of the Roman populace against the conspirators. I totally agree, Cole. Missed opportunity.
I also felt like it kind of made the scene after fall a little flat because, like, we don't hear, like, what all he said. So, like, them talking about, like, how, like, yeah, like, you've turned them all against him, blah, blah. And it's like, I guess.
yeah, that's true. That's true.
If I may counter this, this is one of those times where I'm actually kind of glad we didn't see it. And it's for one reason. I kind of like the idea that we already know that Mark Antony is our big dog on this podcast. We are Mark Antony stands for the show. I like that we don't see it. And the reason is because I kind of like the idea where it could be one perspective will say Mark Antony's speech was legendary and Brutus's speech was not. And some could possibly argue that it might have been a reverse, that Brutus's speech might have been the more honorable one and would have been more respectful, and Antony's would have been kind of the opposite end of that. And so it's kind of that compare and contrast of what each person's perspective of that funeral was, and hearing it about it versus seeing it kind of leads you into interpretation of how that funeral went.
I totally see what you're saying, BP, like how it's a Rorschach test of, you know, what you think says much more about you. I still nonetheless would like to have made that decision for myself and see it.
I also feel like I might be misremembering. I feel like that historically Mark Antony's speech there is like lauded as like a good one.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
But also maybe the other reason is Mark Antony was just dunking on everyone so hard this episode. They were like, we gotta stop. Like, he's already killed them. Like, we can't show
his
speech.
His dog is way too big.
Well, okay, guys. I don't have anything left really on the show outline. So, does anybody have any, I don't know, final thoughts?
Again, I liked this episode. I didn't love it, but I liked it.
And it's I loved it.
And I loved seeing Jacob didn't like seeing Mark Antony's sex scene. He liked seeing the effect afterwards and having his own interpretation.
It's true.
All right. Well, next week we will be watching HBO's Rome season 2, episode 2, Son of Hades. If I recall correctly, and it's been 6 years since I've seen this, this is a real episode. we'll kind of see. It earns that name. Do leave a rating on Apple Pods if you are able to. Listen to Death of the Roman Republic main series podcast. If you want to hear the real history, this episode is mostly chapter 15, Chaos is a Ladder, if I recall correctly, in the HBO's Rome, in the Death of the Roman Republic main series. So sorry. But anyways, my fellow hosts, do you have anything worth promoting in your lives?
You can follow my personal movie review podcast, BP Movie Review Hour, on Spotify, and I'm also working on getting them uploaded to Apple and Google Podcasts as we speak. You can follow me on Twitter if your limit reach is not quite there yet, at BP Movie Review Hour, and you can follow me on Letterboxd at BP Movie Review Hour. If you listened to this podcast last summer, it is still the same Letterboxd account as BP Oil Spill 98. I changed the account name.
Really, really dating the week that we filmed this podcast with that reference there.
I'll be honest, I was also going to make a joke about it.
My name is Jacob. Go by many aliases. You might know me as John Cub. You can follow me on Twitter at SoupCatFishYOLO. I think in the past I talked about a YouTube channel that would eventually have videos on it, and somehow, surprisingly, there's still nothing there. So I still have all.
So you got so many good tweets.
It's true. I've got all these other creative endeavors I'm busy doing. But so I won't even plug it. You know what? I'm not going to waste your time. I'll plug it once I get a video out. That's it. Yeah, follow me on Twitter at SoupCatFishYOLO. Catfish YOLO.
Call any promo?
I do have a Twitter, but you know, I don't I don't know if it's quite up to snuff for the 600 views you're allowed. So, you know, well, I got to workshop some stuff, but we'll see where the next week takes us.
The best bit is back. The best bit.
Cole,
is back.
I think in the breadth of like last summer recording these, like, you know, every episode, I think you at least promoted your Twitter. I don't think in that entire period, though, you actually tweeted once.
I did not. And that makes it way funnier.
With all that being said, friends, Romans, countrymen, I hope you enjoyed the show.